that's not quite enough. The other, we want something a little higher density. And so they took the 50K content and upped it and added a few more of 700K. They call that the GGP HD. There's actually two versions of it, one which is customised for indicus cattle and one which is customised for taurus cattle. And this one is $75 from here, so it's actually a little bit cheaper than the 50K. In fact, we're not using the 50K anymore at the moment. We said, well, maybe there's a few Charolais samples being done. So just to show you the comparison of those chips, so here is the 700K alumina chip, and here in the green I have the 70K chip. So other than a bit of custom content, the 70K chip is pretty well all off the 700K chip. Here in black is the 50K chip, and there are 28,000 in common between the 50K chip and the 70K HD chip. So when we run the 70K HD chip right now, we have to impute from the 20K that are on the 50 up to the 50K and then run the 50K predictions. So all our breed association predictions at the moment are based on the 50K SNPs, but we've dropped out all of the markers on chromosome unknown. So we use all the mapped markers of the 50K in our prediction equation. If they're genotype on HD, we pull off the 28, impute them up to the 50 mapped markers and run the prediction. The red one here is the Super LD, so that has 19K or a bit over 19K, and all of those are on the are on 70K, but it only includes 10K in common with the 50K chip. So for breed associations like Hereford that have a lot of data at 50K, what I've recommended to them is that they use the HD for a little while so that we have 28 in common for imputation, and then we drop down to the 20K, and that will give us 20,000 in common with the HD. So as soon as we get enough on there, we'll impute the 50s up to 70 and see if that helps us with prediction in some particular areas. So imputation now is a big thing. So part of the pipeline that runs at GeneSeq is imputation. So when the final report file comes, it's not just a simple matter of running a prediction equation. We have to split the data by chromosome. We have to run the imputation on each chromosome. We have to put it back together on the 50K panel and then run the predictions of those. So all of that is built on the virtual machine at GeneSeq. So all of that runs hopefully smoothly, has done so far, either from the LD or from the HD, and the pipeline's all been set up automatically, reads the header file from the final report and works out which version of the chip it is. So imputation has advantages with these various chip options, and I had a couple of slides there on imputation, but I think given the nature of the audience here, I think I'll just skip the little details about how we do imputation and just show you the results of imputation. So this is with the current American Hereford Association panel. And what a lot of people do with imputation is they compare the genotypes that were actually measured with the genotypes when they pretend some are missing and impute them up. And they show you that they have these correlations of whatever it is, 98 or 99. What we think really matters is not how we impute the genotypes, it's what the imputed predictive ability is. So we go back to our K-fold validation and we remove all of the markers other than the ones on the lower density chip, and we rerun the whole analysis, and we plot it here in terms of the genetic correlation we get for the trait based on the imputed data. And when you do this, the accuracy drop is a little bit different from one trait to another, because it depends where the QTL coincide with whether you have good imputation or poor imputation. One of the things we've learned about genomics is that the genome is incredibly heterogeneous, and what happens in one part of the genome is quite different from what happens in another part. And so imputation works well in some places and not so well in others. So here we see, say, a marbling error imputed, and this is imputed from using the LD, so where there's only 10K in common, of course, would be better than this from the HD. So some like Barbie, we don't get any drop at all, and others like birth weight, we get a drop of 0.02. We actually got a bigger drop before when we did imputation based on the training of over 1,000 animals. better prediction of patients. Okay. So the other thing that's being of interest in running these analyses is QTL. And I've mentioned before that there are four regions that come up really big in a whole lot of traits. And Jerry mentioned these earlier. There's chromosome 7, chromosome 6, and different bleeds across one or other centiorgans. One on chromosome 20, and the one on chromosome 14, which bleeds across three different centiorgans, but we imagine is likely to be the plague. Plague 1 mutation, and we believe we have the plague 1 mutation on the new LD chip. We haven't validated it yet, but we're hoping that will resolve some of this issue that we've got here. But one of the things that's interesting is that no matter which one of these breeds you run, one of these same regions seems to pop up. And just running short on here with just a few hundred animals, it was enough to pick up horned poll and it was enough to pick up roan. But their ban was the 638, 639 QTL, accounting for 12% of the variation for birth weight. No signal on 793, no signal on the plague 1 region, or signal on the chromosome 20 region. So we're trying to develop routine methods to learn more about these that run automatically whenever we do the training. And one of the things we're getting into is a lot more multi-trait genome prediction. So what I'm showing you here in black on the top, these are whole genome correlations. So these are correlations we've estimated from the whole genome analyses. So just like we can estimate the heritability in a whole genome analysis, these are correlations estimated in a whole genome analysis. And we can generate the whole posterior distribution, so we get standard errors and everything for them. But this is between just five of the traits. And then what I'm showing you below is three of these QTL windows that are having a big impact. And so this chromosome 6 at 38 megabases, this is just for the American Hereford Association data. It accounts for 19% of the variation in birth weight based on the 50K chip data. If we do it with 700K, it's even more than that. So 19% of the variation in birth weight, it drops down to 5% for weaning weight, crawls back up to 8% for yearling weight, 13% for mature cow weight, and accounts for 30% of the variation of calving ease. The next biggest QTL we have for birth weight, 8% of the variation of birth weight, but interestingly it only drops a tiny bit for weaning weight, and then it's about the same, 7% for yearling weight. So this one seems to have a big effect early in life and late in life, whereas this one seems to be a little bit more consistent, but then it has an even bigger effect on mature cow weight, 17%, and a 9% effect on calving ease. And the last one, chromosome 7, 93, 4%, and then it seems to erode down to about 2%. So we're very interested to try and work out, if not the causal mutation, at least the tag SNP that tags the haplotypes of those, because we think from properly recognising those three and the plague 1, which we think we have the causal on, should work well. Plague 1 is a little bit of a problem because the real causal polymorphism doesn't actually SNP genotype very well. So most of the genotyping for it has been done with another one that's a perfect LD with it. Of course, that could vary from one breed to another. So just to show you what happens, again, this is looking at Herefords, and I'm sorry, these counts here are based only on about 950, but under 1,000 of them. But here are those three regions at 7 megabases, 7 chromosomes, chromosome 7, 6, and chromosome 20. And what I'm showing you here are the 50K genotype haplotypes on them. And so this one, chromosome 7, more than half of the haplotypes are just this particular one. So there's three or four haplotypes that are very, very common, and then the other ones we see only, say, 20 times out of these 900 animals. So we think that we should at least be able to get very good predictions of each of these haplotypes as to whether they carry the big Q allele or the little Q allele for each of these QTL. And here, chromosome 6, there's a little bit more diversity. The most common one is there only 200 times. So even when we get down to the bottom of this list, this is still a more common haplotype. So there's a lot of diversity in terms of haplotype distribution of different genome, and here it is on chromosome 20. So that's what we see in Herefords. And if we look at the haplotypes that exist in different breeds, we were interested, are they the same haplotypes or not? And here I've labelled the haplotypes, and I've just taken their sequence of zeros and ones, and I've treated that as a binary number, and I've worked out the decimal conversion of it. So 1655, if you can convert that to a binary, it's a series of zeros and ones, it'll be one of the haplotypes on the previous slide. And what we find is some of these haplotypes we see in all four of these four breeds we've looked at. Some of the haplotypes we only see in three of the breeds, but we see in all sort of combinations of the three. Some of them we see in only two of the breeds, and some of them we see in only one of the breeds. And one of the things that was kind of interesting is that there was way more haplotype diversity in the Lindsay here than there was in any of those other breeds. So again, one of the problems we have with Lindsay, it may be nothing to do with myostatin, it might be because this haplotype, although it looks the same, if these are common haplotypes, they're the most likely haplotype for a mutation to occur. So there's no guarantee, just because we see the same haplotype in Angus, Hereford, Lindsay and Simmental, that they all have exactly the same QTL allele embedded in them. And in fact, if it was the case that in one breed it had a big Q and another breed it had a little Q, that would really screw up the predictions when we put these breeds together. So it's one of the things we're trying to clarify on those haplotypes. So we're trying to put in place methodology so that when we run these analyses, we automatically get the segregation status of every animal. So we predict the probability of big Q, big Q, big Q, little Q, little Q, little Q. So what we do is we fit a mixture model, so we have a distribution of the breeding values in that window, and we assume that distribution is a mixture of three distributions of the different QTLs. And we work out the probability each animal belongs to one or other of those, and we run a little Markov chain on it. And we still have to determine just how well that works. One of the other issues that we've been very interested in, a lot of people have asked us to do some work on, is multiple trait genomic prediction. So the original methods that we use, the Bayesian implementation, Bayes A, Bayes B, Bayes C, Bayes N, and so on, we've been working on a all single trait. And we have known for quite a while how we can do the multiple trait. We did do some preliminary multiple trait analyses a while ago on fatty acids, but we didn't have any postdoc who was particularly interested until recently, so he's gone back. And we now have prototype multi-trait predictions running in Bayes A and Bayes B and Bayes C and Bayes C pi, where we concurrently run the different traits. There are a number of philosophical issues about it, and I'm not sure that it's, the more I learn about it, the more complex it gets. When you fit when you look at the kind of models that we use, the first distinction of a model is that you could fit all the SNP effects, or you could assume that some of the SNP effects are zero. And if you assume that some are zero and some are non-zero, we call that a mixture. And that's what Bayes B is, and that's what Bayes C is. And you have to say what fraction you think might be zero or might be non-zero. So when you go to multiple trait prediction, if you extend the idea there, so supposing I've got three traits, so when you say here's a particular locus that we think might have an impact on these three traits, it could affect all three, or it could affect any one of the three pairwise combinations of two traits, or any one of the three combinations of one trait. So that locus might be informative for all three traits, for just two of the traits, or for just one of the trait. And so in order to run these Bayesian analyses, you have to have a prior distribution. So you've actually got, for a three-trait system, you've actually got six possible different distributions. So somehow you have to say what your prior belief is about how much information comes, how many of the loci do you think affect all three traits, how many affect various pairwise combinations, how many affect one, and how many affect none. And I just don't know where you get those kind of numbers from. So in a single trait set, we just pull this number pi, it's just a number between 0 and 1, and we can estimate it from the data. But in a trivariate case, there's going to be six of those. compared to the audience. And so who would like to tell me what proportion of loci affect birth weight and affect weaning weight? The fact that the correlation's not one suggests that some of the loci affect just one trait and some of the loci affect just the other. And we can't have, say, a pie for birth weight and a pie for weaning weight and multiply them together and assume that's the number that affect both. Because when we run 700k analyses, pi is a number like 0.9997. If you did that, you'd find that your prior assumption was that nothing affected both traits. Now, in theory, in a Bayesian analysis, you're meant to have Bayesian learning. And Bayesian learning means that your prior belief gets overwhelmed by whatever's contained in the data. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen in these kind of models. And the reason it doesn't happen is because the prior belief has to be associated with 3 or 4 degrees of freedom in order for the prior distribution to be proper, which has a finite integral. But the data, if you assume every locus has its own variance covariance structure, each locus only brings 1 degree of freedom. So you're bringing 3 or 4 degrees of freedom from the prior and only 1 from the data. And so the data can never overwhelm the prior, even if you have 1 million animals. And so that means the prior assumption you make about the pleiotropic effects of those loci is going to carry all the way through to what you see when you get the final estimates. So at the moment, the way we've implemented it is that a locus is either in or it's out, so we only have 1 pie. And we were just hoping that if the locus was in, but it really didn't affect 1 trait, you would get small estimates of the substitution effect for that trait. We're not sure that that's right, so if somebody has some great philosophical ideas, this is not a statistical problem, we can solve the statistics, but somebody has to write down what would be a sensible model that captures what we know about the biology of these things, then we can work out how to put that into an estimation procedure. But at the moment, the only obvious way we can do is that the locus is in for every trait, or it's out for every trait. And when we do that, it's relatively straightforward to put it going to get it running. The other thing we've been interested in for a while is how to blend animals, how to put together data from animals that are genotyped, and how to put together animals that are not genotyped. And of course, we all know that we can use Henderson's mixed model equations, and usually we would have a G inverse here, which would be a chronic product of an inverse relationship matrix. And with genomic data, the approach that has been suggested, which is called single step, replaces that G inverse with this H inverse, which we heard about in the previous talk. And that H inverse is where you take the A inverse matrix and you augment a little piece of it for the genotyped animals by the difference between these two matrices here. And we have a lot of problems with this from a practical point of view. The first is that this has got to be a brute force inverse of the genomic matrix and a brute force inverse of the relationship matrix. And by the time you get to, say, 100,000 animals genotyped, that becomes a bit of a problem. By the time you get to, say, 500,000, there's just no way that this could possibly be done. The US dairy industry, I think, is up to 350,000 genotyped animals. Now, there's no way they can do this with all the data. And the rounding errors when you invert matrices of those would be a big problem. The next problem is if this G matrix here has been centered to adjust the allele frequency, it's actually a singular matrix. So it doesn't have an inverse, so we know that. So you can't invert it anyway. But if you jam it into some software, it might well come out with an inverse, but it just looks like it's got an inverse because of rounding errors. So we don't like that particular approach for that and a variety of other reasons. So something we've been working on is a method to combine those, and we have a method developed, we've prototyped it, that doesn't require us to invert this matrix. It doesn't require us to invert this matrix. And actually the total size of the equations is smaller than the ones that we see here. And we have been trying to prototype it with 100,000 genotyped animals and 100,000 non-genotyped animals. And it involves making a matrix product. So you have to take an X prime X between a matrix that has all of the genotypes, all of an animal on each row and a genotype in each column. And what we're finding is massive rounding errors on. We're getting massive rounding errors. And you can go to double precision, single precision, and that allows you to add a few more animals before you get massive rounding errors. So even when you use the matrix tools that come off the shelf, the library routines, and you ask them to do the inverses, we're getting massive rounding errors. So we have to go back to some fairly old-fashioned operations research and work out efficient ways to multiply two vectors together without rounding errors. And there are some ways that were developed 30 or 40 years ago to do that. So that's a little bit of a problem. We'll be publishing that method sometime soon. We've applied for a USDA grant for 3 years to look at how to implement that at full national evaluation level. So summary, genomic prediction, it's an immature technology, but what we see routinely is accuracy exceeds parent average EPD, so it does have a role to play. The accuracy is continuously improving. As we get more data and it improves, as we get better methods it improves. The adoption is rapidly accelerating, so we'll probably put a website in place where you can go to on the consortium website, somewhere where you can interrogate how many animals we have of various breeds. We'd actually like to put a website in place where you can actually interrogate whether a particular animal has been genotyped or not, because I have an enormous number of animals that have been genotyped 2, 3, or maybe even 4 times. Sometimes they even get genotyped by the same breed association in successive months. So we want to get away from those kind of problems. And one of the things we have done as part of that exercise is we've changed to an ID system that allows us to recognise, say, an Angus animal, regardless of whether he's used in the American Angus or the Red Angus or the Simmerville Association. We do that using the ICAR and the Interval standard system. So if anybody sends me genotypes and they're not on the Interval standard ID system, I won't put them into our system until they can give me the Interval standard ID. So we hope we get away from those problems we had in the past. I just want to acknowledge a whole lot of the people that have been involved in these consortium projects. But not only is there the research, but there's all the extension activities that are involved in communicating to breed associations and others about what happens with the predictions. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks.